I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. A parent's worst nightmare is to learn that their child is dead. That happened to Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin on February 26, 2012, when they learned their son Trayvon had been killed. He was walking home when George Zimmerman, a volunteer neighborhood watchman, pursued him and shot and killed him. Martin was unarmed. Zimmerman was charged with murder and acquitted on grounds of self-defense. Trayvon Martin's death was an inspiration for Black Lives Matter and a symbol for the vulnerability of young black men, something that President Obama talked about. It also made his parents public figures. They've collaborated on a new book. It's called Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love, Injustice, and the Birth of a Movement. And Sabrina Fulton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us, Tracy Martin. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
You have been telling this story for almost 5 years now. Sabrina, does it ever get easier?
No.
To say this story?
I can't say that it has. Although the calendar says it's been 5 years, it certainly doesn't feel like 5 years to my heart. It feels like it's something that just happened, and I'm still healing from it and still trying to get through it and, you know, just taking one day at a time.
Tracy, does it help to talk about it, though? I mean, to as much as it must bring up the pain of that loss, does it also help to talk about your son?
It's therapeutic to talk about him, and that's because we want to keep him alive. It doesn't heal to talk about him, but it's very therapeutic. It helps us cope with some of the struggles that we go through, some of the emotional ups and downs. And so it does help to talk about him and keep him in the forefront of our lives.
Most people, when they mourn something, they mourn in private. They mourn with family and friends. You have done something very different, Tracy. You are mourning in public.
Yeah, correct. We, as a family, we never had the chance to sit back and just suck in the loss, because from the beginning, we put ourselves on a mission to seek justice for our son, and in doing so, we opened up the doors of our homes to the media, to the public, to the world. And so we've never gotten the chance to just sit back and just say, hey, let's grieve for a moment. Let's take a moment and just think about what we're going through. Or we haven't had a chance to go to counseling and things of that nature. So we're still in the process.
So this is not exactly counseling, but a form of they have in the Jewish tradition, sitting Shiva, where you sit and you talk and you talk and you talk as a way of trying to understand and perhaps even find the words to describe what you're clearly going through. The book is titled Rest in Power, different from Rest in Peace. Sabrina, what do you mean by that?
The reason why we titled the book Rest in Power is because we certainly know that Trayvon is resting in peace in heaven. And so we want people to know that even through the death of Trayvon, his name lives on through the power he has in his parents, in his brothers and sisters, in his family, in his friends. And, you know, we just supporters, just people that continue to try to fight the injustice that's happening in this world. And so it's so much power in the name, not just the hoodie, but in the name Trayvon Martin is so much power. And so that's why we titled the book Rest in Power.
There are alternating chapters. You write a chapter. And one gets, I have to say, a sense of who Trayvon Martin was. And like all kids, they're different to different parents. He called you Cupcake.
Yes.
Why? I mean, nothing better than a cupcake, right?
Well, yeah. The reason why he called me that is because he felt that he had to do everything for me. He was a mama's boy. Absolutely.
Right.
And so he
proudly.
Proudly. I mean, he was a very affectionate. And it didn't matter where he was. You know, usually when they're little kids, you can give them a hug and kiss and send them off to school. I would go to Trayvon's high school. I would be at the park, at the grocery store, and he would give me a hug and a kiss. So it was no secret that he was very affectionate. And so that's one of the things that I really miss about him, and the reason why he called me Cupcake.
And he was called for a while Crazy Legs. Why was that? Why was that? He had long legs, I guess.
Yeah, he had very long legs
as a kid, right?
As a baby, and when he first started walking, he was just all over the place, and it was just funny to us, and we named him Crazy Legs when he first started trying to walk, and those are some of the things that we share with the public through this book some of our most personal and intimate moments with our child.
How would you describe your relationship with your son, Trayvon?
He was my best friend, and as I say in the book, Trayvon saved my life. And just not to be there the night of February 26th was devastating to me. And so we did have a very, very close and personal relationship. We did a lot of things together, and I say in the book that, you know, he was my best friend. When I say that, I truly mean that he was my best friend.
Well, you have another son, Javaris. What's been the effect of all of this on him, Tracy?
It's been tough on Javaris.
And is he older or younger than
older, He's the older brother. And Javaris, but he's handling it as well as can be expected. He's had his breakdowns. He's had his moments because, you know, that's just the nature of being a big brother. You miss your younger brother. You miss being able to teach your younger brother some of the things that you've gone through. He misses some of the things that he wanted, you know, he'd like to show Trayvon, hey, don't do this because, you know, I've tried that and it didn't work out so well. So he's handling it well, but he definitely misses his brother.
Well, you're honest about raising a teenage son. I was a teenager. I raised a teenage son, so I know to some degree about what you're talking about. But he was going through a rough patch, having some problems with school. You do not sugarcoat this, Sabrina?
No, absolutely not. We don't feel like we were the perfect parents, and we don't feel like he was a perfect kid.
They do not exist. I'll just say that.
They don't. But, you know, a lot of times people on the outside looking in, they say, well, why did he do this and why did he do that? We don't have an explanation, and we don't justify what he did. We tell him when things that he did were wrong and his behavior was off track. You know, we told him those things. He got back on track. To us, he was going through growing pains. I mean, it's nothing that you don't see from other teenage young men and also our young ladies as well. You know, they go through that stage where they're struggling between the teenage years and becoming an adult. It's just unfortunate that he did not get a chance to live his life to become an adult because he could have worked through all of that, you know, and at the same time, we don't justify. We don't try to justify. The reason why he did this was because of that. No, you did it. That's the decision you made at 17 years old.
You say you didn't like the hoodie. I mean, so much of the hoodie has been associated with Trayvon Martin, which we should talk about. But you said, Sabrina, early on, you know, it wasn't a favorite garment of yours. Let's put it that way.
It wasn't. It was, to me, I just couldn't understand why he wore it so much. And then I started looking at some of the other teenagers. And, of course, they would wear this hoodie all the time. It's hot in Florida. And they had this hoodie on. And so one of the things that came to mind is when I was in college, I had these jeans and they zipped up in the back. And when my mom saw those jeans, she hit the roof. And she was like, oh, no, you're not wearing those jeans. But it was the fashion at the time. And so I kind of understood and I kind of gave him a pass because I had those jeans that zipped up in the back and she didn't understand it. Right. So the generations change. And you know, we just got to be open to what our kids are doing. You know, I don't think I could have had him to wear a bone in his nose or, you know, something crazy like that. But I accepted the hoodie for what it was, a fashion statement.
He was actually staying with you. You divorced when Trayvon was about five. So he was staying with you, Tracy, on the night he got killed.
Yeah, he was. We were together in the Central Florida area. We sent him up. He was suspended from school, and we just didn't want him to be at home by himself. I had plans to go to Central Florida that weekend, and so I decided to send him up before I got up there, and he was up there a couple of days enjoying himself. It wasn't like he had never been there. Of course, he's been there before, but just to have his life taken away from him on my watch, away from home, was something that I've been dealing with a long time.
I'm sure a lot of people listening say, well, I know what happened that night. I know what happened to Trayvon Martin. I want to give you both a chance to say, what don't we know?
Well, I don't think what we don't know is we really don't know what happened those 71 seconds. But what I can definitely tell you is the fact that if you are a 28-year-old adult and you are afraid of your life and the 911 caller tell you not to get out your vehicle, and you go get out your vehicle anyway with a loaded a loaded 9mm, you're not afraid of anything. You're definitely looking for some trouble, and that's what we felt, that this individual was definitely looking for trouble that night.
Why do you think George Zimmerman killed your son?
He wanted to prove a point. There's so much hatred in the world that he wanted to prove a point. He felt that his life wasn't worth anything, and that's why it's so important that we continue to say Black Lives Matter, because people look at Black Lives so nonchalantly. We all know that Trayvon was not carrying a weapon, that his only weapon was candy and a drink. We know that Trayvon was on the phone at the time, that he was 17 years old and not paying attention to somebody following him, somebody chasing him, pursuing him, profiling him, and murdering him. Mm. He was not aware of what was going on in his surroundings.
Tracy, you write about hearing the scream. You were in the police department, being talked to or asked questions of, and you were told to listen, or you listened to the scream. What did you hear? And you said, at least the way you wrote about it, you weren't sure who was screaming.
Well, first of all, the first time I listened to the tapes, I was played the tapes, bits and pieces of the tapes. And this was probably about 2 days after Trayvon was killed. And so just to hear the screams on the tape, you know, I'm dealing with the loss of my son and trying to figure out why is he dead, how I was approached with the tapes was, I just want you to listen to something. I didn't know what the tapes were, and they were played. Listen to a piece of this. Listen to a piece of this. Listen to a piece of this. And so that wasn't mentioned in the trial. What was mentioned in the trial was someone sitting 15, 20 feet behind me that I never knew was in the police department saying that they heard me acknowledge that I said that it wasn't my son. And what I did say was, I can't, you know, I wasn't for sure what was going on the tape. And so it's a situation whereas someone was just trying to say that I said that, no, that wasn't Trayvon screaming, and that wasn't the case at all.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton, the parents of Trayvon Martin. I guess in many ways you'll be known as the parents of Trayvon Martin. Their book is titled Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love, Injustice, and the Birth of a Movement. And I should add that this Sunday, Trayvon Martin would have been 22 years old. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin are our guests. They are the founders, co-founders of the Trayvon Martin Foundation, which aims to create community programming, raise awareness about the impact of gun violence and racial profiling on families. And they've also co-authored a new book called Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love, Injustice, and the Birth of a Movement. Let me play a clip from President Obama. This was shortly after the death of Trayvon Martin. He's speaking at the White House Rose Garden about being a black parent and also the death of Trayvon Martin.
But my main message is to the parents of Trayvon Martin. You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. And, you know, I think they are right to expect that all of us, as Americans, are going to take this with the seriousness it deserves, and that we're going to get to the bottom of exactly what happened.
Sabrina, what did those words mean to you when he said, if I had a son, it could have been Trayvon, or would have been Trayvon?
I think what the president is saying is he is connecting himself with what happened to us, because it could have been anyone. Trayvon Martin could have been anybody's son. And the president wanted to make it crystal clear, even though he got a lot of backlash because of what he said. I just feel like he meant it. It came from the heart. We were overwhelmed that the president was speaking about the tragedy, because, as you know, the tragedies happen all over the country, and he can't, you know, speak specifically on each one. But just to give it the time that it needed, we was gracious.
Looking back at the trial, the prosecution, as we know, George Zimmerman was not found guilty. In fact, was basically let off. He has had altercations with law enforcement after this. But what do you think, Tracy, the prosecutors could have done better or different? Do you relive that?
Yeah, every day. I think as a parent, I truly feel as though the state of Florida could have brought Trayvon to life more. And by that, I mean, the state didn't call no character witnesses in Trayvon's defense. And you know, the state really, really just let the defense summarize who Trayvon was. The state, they were okay with the defense bringing in a slab of concrete saying that this was a weapon. They were okay with just not really letting the public know who Trayvon Martin was.
You don't use the name George Zimmerman. You call him the killer.
Correct.
In this book. You just cannot say his name.
I just don't want to say his name. I just think that the more attention that we give this person's name or this person's face, I think that it's taken away from what we're trying to do.
Sabrina, one of the jurors, I remember saying Trayvon played a huge role in his death. I mean, there were many things that were said about your son and also about the trial. What do you think the jury did not understand about this case?
I think the jury didn't understand the culture of African Americans. That's one thing they didn't understand. They did not see Trayvon as if he was their son because of the color of his skin, which was the same reason why he was shot and killed. And so we sat in the courtroom and we listened to the jury selection, and we listened to all African Americans being kicked off of the jury pool. So now we're just left with people who didn't quite understand who Trayvon Martin was. But I'm sure in hindsight, with all the things that has transpired since, they have given it a second thought about the decision that they made, and they have to live with those decisions.
So what would justice for your son look like? What would that mean?
For me, justice is different from most people. For justice, for me, would bring my son back. I mean, that's the 100% justice for me. Even if somebody went to jail, it would take the edge off. But I just feel like, you know, there's no repairing this situation. It's just absolutely irreparable. And you can't break a mirror and then glue it back together and expect it to be the same. You know, so we just have to learn how to adjust to this new lifestyle, learn how to adjust to this new life without my son.
I read that you're both, or one of you, or both of you are considering running for office.
Both.
Both. Not against each other, I hope.
No.
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 Why? I mean, what would that give you, Tracy?
Well, I think what it does is we speak so much about making change, about changing policies, changing procedures, being active in the communities, being a voice for the voiceless. And so we feel as though in order to make a change, you have to be a part of the change. I think that we have a platform right now where we can galvanize people and rationalize with people and get people to understand that this is a way to go. This is how you be politically correct about certain things, and you know, we just want to get engaged in our communities. We want to start on the local level and see what we can do in our own communities, and who knows where it'll take us.
You know, I was thinking there's so few divorced parents who could come together and spend as much time as I'm sure the two of you do in a sense, putting children ahead of whatever mm-hmm. caused the divorce. I think that's a really rare experience to have parents who can do that or have a former husband and wife to be able to do that. And I'm just curious to you, Sabrina, what it's been like.
Is that the reason why so many people call me Miss Martin, because they think we're still married or something?
But it is. It's unusual. I have to say that. And I'm saying that as a compliment.
Thank you.
I want you to know that.
Okay. I'm going to take that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
When we first got divorced, we made a decision. And that decision was that we would always put the best interests of the children before us. And so even though we didn't work things out in the relationship, we made sure that we were good parents to the kids. And Tracy always say that they didn't even know that we were divorced. The
really?
Kids didn't know that we were divorced. They knew he wasn't in the house, but they would be back and forth. And so they really didn't know. And so I don't think I have to hate him. I don't think, you know, it has to be, you know, issues there. We do fight, but the public doesn't see that part. Yeah. You know, we don't always get along, you know.
It's not always peaches and cream.
I'm sure I aggravate him sometimes, and he does aggravate me sometimes.
I hear you.
But we don't air that in the public, you know. And so we try to put the best foot forward. Our interests were always the kids, and that's what we felt was important.
Well, that says a lot about the two of you, I have to say. And I did post something on Facebook about just having seen you for the last 5 years talking about the loss, the death of your son. And I was always I just thought I could not do that. I couldn't sit there and talk in public about something so tragic.
It's tough. But as parents, we don't want people to remember Trayvon as how he died. And so that's what helps us with the conversation. We want, you know, we want people to remember him as the child we knew him as. And I know that's difficult for a lot of people because they want to see the opposite. They want to see him as a thug. They want to see him as someone who was up to no good. And in fact, the detectives even said that Trayvon Martin was absolutely doing nothing. And so our conversation, our dialogue is basically us talking about our son, humanizing him, and showing America that this was a good kid.
Well, it's been such a great pleasure, frankly, an honor to have you both on the show. Thank you very much. And I should read an email from Gina. My heart goes out to you. I do my best to use Trayvon as an example of racial attitudes that have to change. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And their book is called Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love, Injustice, and the Birth of a Movement. They are on their way to the Free Library of Philadelphia at noon. And then they will be actually back at the Free Library tonight, I believe, at 7:30. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Yesterday, National Security Advisor Michael Flynn responded to Iran's recent ballistic missile launch with this warning.
The Trump administration condemns such actions by Iran that undermine security, prosperity, and stability throughout and beyond the Middle East, and which places American lives at risk. President Trump has severely criticized the various agreements reached between Iran and the Obama administration, as well as the United Nations, as being weak and ineffective. Instead of being thankful to the United States in these agreements, Iran is now feeling emboldened. As of today, we are officially putting Iran on notice. Thank you.
Flynn said that the launch and attacks on vessels in the region threaten the region, violate a UN security resolution, and demonstrate the weakness and failures of the Obama administration. We asked Joe Cirincione to talk about the test, the Trump administration's response, and what this could mean for national security. He's the president of the Plowshares Fund, and that's a global security foundation. And Joe Cirincione, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty. Thanks for having me.
So what does it mean to put a country or put Iran on notice?
That is not a national security term of art. It has left a lot of people puzzled as to understand what that is. In the generous interpretation is that it's meant to be vague. It's meant to be unpredictable. This is part of Donald Trump's M.O., you know, that I may be crazy, you can't depend on me taking the rash, what you think is a rational step. So you are on notice. I may act if you do something I don't like. The less generous interpretation is that they're not sure what they're doing, that it's a little odd to have the national security advisor come out and sort of bolt into a press conference and make this announcement. There's concerns that it might be a bit of an internal power struggle. Many of the press reports on Michael Flynn, the national security advisor, are that he's on the outs, and Stephen Bannon, the strategic counselor, has more the ear of the president. Maybe this was a push to get him back in the limelight. It could have been intended to distract some attention from the serious situation in Ukraine, where Russian-backed forces are escalating their combat against Ukrainians. But the big concern that many people in this town have is that it doesn't appear to have been coordinated necessarily, that it isn't the central command, the commander of the troops in the region, didn't understand that this was coming. It isn't clear what the instructions are for him and the troops now that we've put Iran on notice.
Well, let me ask you, because Iran did launch ballistic missiles, I believe medium-range ballistic missiles, over the weekend on Sunday. Why did they do that, and what do we need to know about these missiles?
Sure. Well, Iran has had a missile program for quite a long time, ever since they were invaded by Iraq in 1981. The missile that they tested on Sunday was similar to the missiles that Saddam Hussein used to pelt Iranian cities. That is, they travel what we call medium range, about 600 miles. So this is not something that can reach the United States. They're not close to that capability. And all the missiles they have, the farthest they can possibly go is Israel, a little bit of southern Europe, Turkey, southern Greece. That's the farthest they can go. Two, these missiles carry conventional warheads, much like the Scuds we saw in the Gulf Wars. So they're not a nuclear threat. They don't threaten mass destruction. The test program has actually slowed down in recent years, ever since we started negotiating with them over the nuclear deal. They used to have about five tests a year. Now they have about two tests a year. This is the first of their tests in 2017. It's not a particularly aggressive test program.
But why are they testing them? Why are they testing these missiles?
Oh, they don't have much of an air force. And from the Iranian point of view, this is a deterrent. They are trying to deter other people from attacking them. And Saudi Arabia, for example, one of their rivals in the region, has a substantial, very sophisticated air force. So they use the missiles as a deterrent to say, if you attack us, we're going to hit back. That's what the Iranians say they're doing, and so therefore they need to keep modernizing and developing their missile force.
Now, the White House, or Flynn, has said this was in defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 223. What does that mean?
Yeah. When we concluded the deal that rolled back Iran's nuclear program and froze it for 15 years, part of that included a resolution calling upon Iran not to test any further missiles. This replaced a resolution that prohibited Iran from testing missiles. So it softened the language. So what they did is most countries, except for the United States, do not consider this a violation of that. That is, the language was hortatory rather than mandatory. Don't do this rather than you are prohibited from doing this. So technically it's not a violation, but it certainly is. It goes against the spirit of the resolution. So you're likely to see the UN Security Council, as they say in diplomatic parlance, express their concern about Iranian actions.
Well, you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me read some language from this resolution. Tehran is not to undertake any activity related to ballistic missiles designed to be capable of delivering nuclear weapons, including launches using such ballistic missile technology. You're saying the difference is this was not carrying a nuclear warhead.
Right. So look at that language. It was very carefully crafted, designed to be capable. Right. So here's what the administration said, and this is what they said in their briefing yesterday afterwards for reporters around 4 o'clock yesterday. They said, look, by definition, a missile that can go this far and can carry a 500-kilogram warhead is nuclear capable. That is true. And that is the standard definition. If you can go over 300 miles, carry a 500-kilogram warhead, that is nuclear capable. You could carry a small primitive nuclear warhead. But was it designed to be nuclear capable? And that's what the Iranians say. We don't have nuclear warheads. We're not designing this. This is just a standard part. We've been doing this for years. This is part of our deterrent force. In fact, the language was crafted in order to be able to be interpreted in different ways in order to bridge this diplomatic gap.
But is it a semantic game that's being played?
Well, Iran doesn't have a nuclear warhead, so if you're asking
what's
the threat...
It does not. You can tell us that, for sure.
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt about that. That's what the Iran deal did. You know, it didn't fix Iran meddling in the region. It didn't improve human rights in Iran. It's not a cure for cancer. It did one thing and only one thing only. It blocked Iran from building a bomb. They are now, if they were to start from ground zero, from a dead start today, it would take them at least a year to make the material for one bomb, let alone fashion it into a warhead. So they don't have a weapon. So whatever you're worried about their missiles, don't be worried about it being a nuclear missile. And those restraints on Iran last for 15 years. So, and they're under the strictest inspection regime ever negotiated in history. This is the toughest nonproliferation accord I've ever seen. So you don't have to worry about that. And in fact, that's not really what General Flynn was saying yesterday. What he was pointing out was the missile test and this aid to the Houthis. He was zeroing in on Iran's other activities. They went out of their way in the press briefing later to point out that they were not questioning the nuclear agreement with Iran, that they were not intending to upturn that agreement.
Well, I do want to talk about those other activities. Let's take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Joe Cirincione is our guest, president of the Plowshares Fund. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoway, and we're talking about something that President Trump's National Security Advisor Michael Flynn said yesterday, that the United States was putting Iran on notice after the country had conducted ballistic missile tests over the weekend, also made some comments about attacks on vessels in the region, frankly, something that has been going on for some time now. And again, Joe Cirincione is our guest, president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation. And he also was a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board and the Council on Foreign Relations, has written several books as well. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me ask you, and this gets into some detail, but I think, Joe, an important detail to understand. Michael Flynn also talked about these militants attacking Saudi naval vessels, Houthi militants saying that they were doing it with the support, perhaps, of financial and otherwise from Iran. Help us understand what's going on there.
Yeah. You may wonder why the United States is involved in a civil war in an Asian country far from our shores, but we are. And this is Yemen, a very poor country at the bottom of the Saudi peninsula there. And the Houthis are a major ethnic group within Yemen. And in 2012, they overthrew the government. They consider the government corrupt and incompetent. And they stormed into the capital and took it over. The president had to flee the country. He sought the aid of the Saudis. The Saudis came to his aid. In turn, the Houthis then sought the aid of the Iranians. The Iranians have been giving them some training, giving them some money. I think most experts agree that the Iranians don't control the Houthis. It's sort of like the Soviets aiding the North Vietnamese during the Vietnamese Civil War. Mm. You know, a serious ally, but not in control. The Saudis have now been bombing Aden, the capital, one of the major cities in Yemen, for some time, since about 2015, and they've killed about 10,000 civilians in the process. The Houthis are trying to attack the Saudis and push them back, and that's why you saw over the weekend a suicide raft attack a Saudi vessel off the coast of Yemen. The raft blew up. Two Saudi sailors were killed. A few weeks ago, there was also a missile attack launched against apparently what the Houthis thought was a Saudi ship, turned out to be a U.S. ship. Mm. No injuries there, but it came close. That's what's going on, and those are the two incidents that Michael Flynn cited yesterday. And he blames the Houthis for this. And, well, more directly, he says the Iranians did this, and he's pinning this all on the Iranians, and that's part of his somewhat vague red line of you are now on notice. And so what you're worried about is if there's some other action by the Houthis against the Saudis, whom they're now engaged in a war with, that somehow that will trigger a U.S. military response. And that's what has experts worried. Are we on a slippery slope of war with Iran over this civil conflict in Yemen?
Well, I remember in the summer, in fact, I looked at some of old videos in preparation for the show when there were Iranian, almost like speedboats in a way, I would say harassing U.S. vessels. And I even saw some of these U.S. vessels firing not directly at but close to these boats that were from Iran. Let me play something that presidential candidate Donald Trump said when he was speaking at a rally. This was in Pensacola, Florida on September 9th about these such incidents. And let's give that a listen.
With Iran, when they circle our beautiful destroyers with their little boats and they make gestures at our people that they shouldn't be allowed to make, they will be shot out of the water. Okay? Believe me.
Joe, are you concerned that President Trump will shoot them out of the water?
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is what's most concerning about this kind of talk. And it's one thing to say it on the campaign trail. It's another thing for the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States to burst into a press conference and make this kind of announcement. And it's another thing to make this kind of announcement before your national security team is fully in place. So the Secretary of State has just been sworn in yesterday.
Right.
The Secretary of Defense is brand new. He's on a trip to South Korea. The Director of Central Intelligence, brand new. The staff of the National Security Council isn't fully in place. It appears that the head of the Central Command didn't really fully know about this. Oh, and there's one other report that Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, had to tone down the statement that Michael Flynn wanted to make. So you're worried that the whole government isn't coordinated. That's what makes for a very dangerous situation, because they're in the Persian Gulf. U.S. combat ships, destroyers, cruisers, frigates, do come very close to the naval vessels run by the Iranian naval vessels run by the Revolutionary Guard. The Revolutionary Guard is a hardline faction within the Iranian government. They want to provoke the United States. If they do some of their provocative actions, and they're right, you're right, they have done this. They do sort of, you know, taunt our ships. If the Central Command is ordered to fire them out of the water, to blow them out of the water, well, that's an act of war. The Iranians are not going to back down. There will be a retaliation, and bang, there you go. You could start a war with Iran that would make the war with Iraq and Afghanistan look like warm-up acts.
So what should the U.S. do? I mean, this is not just under the Trump administration, but under the Obama administration. What do you do about the kind of taunting, harassing in open waters?
Well, you remember who's got the power here. And you push them back, and there is only you can't come so close. And in fact, the U.S. over the years has in fact fired warning shots, and you establish what we used to do with the Soviets. We haven't done this yet with the Iranians. Rules of engagement. So even during the coldest days of the Cold War, you would have agreements with Soviet naval commanders about where we would operate, how we would operate, so to avoid an unnecessary provocation. That's the kind of thing you could open up with the Iranians to make sure that the conflict doesn't start by accident. The other things you can do, for example, on the missile tests is to enforce export controls. The Iranian program is very primitive. Mm. They depend heavily on imported technology. You tighten that up, you restrict that, you engage. And finally, the one thing you could do is you could start engaging the Iranians. If you don't want them to do certain things, start negotiating with them. We did not want them to continue building the capability for a nuclear bomb. We negotiated with them. We stopped them from doing that. Other deals like that are possible.
Do you think, though, that Iran is taking advantage of the changing from one administration to the other? There have been some, you know, some hiccups, I should say, in the transition. There's apparently a revolt within the State Department about the immigration ban. We now do have a Secretary of State, but I wonder whether all of this churn and turmoil has made Iran feel that they could take advantage of the situation somehow. Be provocative.
I don't see evidence of that. The Iranian behavior hasn't changed very much. As I say, the test program is a fairly modest one. It's gone on apace. They're not doing anything new with the Houthis. They're not being more aggressive. I mean, yes, we object. They are doing some terrible things in the region. They are doing some terrible things to their own people. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of issues with this dictatorial autocratic regime. But is it fundamentally different now that Trump is president? No, it's not. Is it on the march? No, I don't think so. It's a troubled region in conflict, and Iran is one of those conflict actors. But to try to solve the civil war in Yemen by just focusing on one side is a recipe for disaster. You can't do it that way. You've got to be pushing the Saudis as well to stop their military action. You want to cease fire in Yemen? Then you've got to talk to both sides.
Candidate Trump certainly talked about the bad deal with Iran. He called it a disaster, among other things. Oh. And he seemed to indicate that as president, he could negotiate a better one. Now, this is not a bilateral deal. This is a multilateral deal. Can he do that?
Well, there is actually a path to doing that. The first thing is you have to understand there are people in this government now, like, for example, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, who want to tear down the deal, right, who went in saying, we want to get rid of this deal. That's not what Trump is saying right now. And none of our allies are saying that. Even people who were against the deal, like the Saudis, now say you've got to keep it. It's in place. Senators who voted against the deal, like Bob Corker, the Republican head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, or Chuck Schumer, the Democratic minority leader, are saying, we didn't like it, but now you got to keep it in place. Why? Because it works. Iran is not going to get a bomb under this deal for at least 15 years. It's in place. It works. You have other issues. Deal with those other issues. But there are some who still want to break the deal. Why? Because in their view, the only real solution to the Iranian problem is to overthrow the regime in Iran. They have a similar strategy to the strategy that got us into the war in Iraq. So you see people trying to provoke the Iranians or to undercut the deal, death by a thousand cuts, some people call it. So you're afraid that in this internal struggle, in this still rather chaotic administration, some of those hardliners, those people who want to tear things down, will get the upper hand over the people like Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State, who didn't like the deal when it was made but now support it, and those forces of stability will be pushed aside by the forces of chaos. That's the kind of situation you're facing on a bunch of fronts. In this particular front, this is the closest we could come to actual war, to actual combat, compared to all the other problems we're facing.
What about 50-some years ago, we did overthrow the government of Mossadegh in Iran, and I think in many ways have paid the price for that in all sorts of ways. Do you think that's a really serious option that's being considered?
That's right. People forget that Iran used to have a democratically elected
Apparently no
government.
One in Iran has forgotten this, but perhaps in the United States we have.
That is exact. Very few people in America understand that we, the CIA and the British intelligence services, overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953. Every Iranian knows it. Every Iranian knows it. So is it possible here? Yes. Yes. Talk to Lindsey Graham. Talk to John McCain. There are people on the TV today talking about what a lousy deal this was and how we've got to push Iran more. This quote you just played from Donald Trump, this is what the hardline sort of neoconservative groups in Washington are saying. Let's blow a few Revolutionary Guard troops out of the water. That would be a good start. They firmly believe that if we press Iran more, if we militarily press Iran more, that Iran will either back down or we will go to a war that we will quickly win. This is the kind of fantasy thinking that led us into the Iraq War. It is alive and well in Washington and, unfortunately, in certain sectors of the Trump administration.
And again, that's Joe Cerincione, and he's president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation. He was a member of Secretary of State John Kerry's International Security Advisory Board and the Council on Foreign Relations. Has written several books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Bomb Scare, all with very scary titles.
And they're romance novels.
Right, romance novels, just involving nuclear weapons. Let me get Linda from Princeton to join our conversation. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hello, Marty. I have a question for Mr. Cerincione.
Sure.
Last summer, on the second to last or the final night of the Republican National Convention, Brian Lehrer from the NPR affiliate in New York asked Mr. Michael Flynn about ISIS. And his Flynn's response was that the way to stop ISIS would be to blow up all of the oil wells in Iraq to stop the sale of on the black market of oil by ISIS to outside agents. No one followed up on this, and I'm imagining that even if we didn't hear this in the United States, if we weren't paying close attention, I'm sure people around the world heard this online.
Well,
and I checked with a physicist at Princeton. It would take it would take mini nukes or tactical nukes to blow up those oil wells, and I'd like a response to that.
Sure. Thanks for calling, Linda. Thanks. Joe, go ahead.
Sure. Two things. You're right. ISIS was and still is getting a big part of its revenues from its control of oil in Iraq and parts of Syria that it's taken over. There was a hesitancy to actually go after that infrastructure because this actually belongs to the Syrian people and the Iraqi people, and they didn't want to destroy it. But as ISIS consolidates controls, more and more we have been going after those facilities, blowing up the refineries, blowing up the wells, and in fact have crippled a lot of the ISIS sales of oil. We've been doing that by conventional means. A nuclear weapon? Well, that is an extreme measure. There has not been a military mission that required the use of a nuclear weapon in 72 years now. If you use a nuclear weapon in an Asian country again, the international repercussions would be severe, not to mention the damage that would go in the region. You don't, and the truth is you don't need to use a nuclear weapon. We have conventional forces that can do this. The only thing that's stopping us from blowing more up is a feeling that we can defeat them in other ways, and we'd rather leave the infrastructure in place for the Iraqi people to possess once again.
Almost out of time. Unfair question. Is the U.S. nuclear arsenal safe under the new Secretary of the Energy Department?
Rick Perry didn't really realize that the Energy
Department. The
department
he wanted to get, or he couldn't remember, I think.
60% of what the Energy Department does is control nuclear weapons. Fortunately, I think we have a skilled and very well-funded infrastructure in place for taking care of our nuclear weapons. The Secretary may have a learning curve here, but I think the arsenal is safe for a while at least.
Are we looking at war?
In Iran? With Iran?
Yeah.
I think this is a possibility. Do I think it's likely? No. And the reason I don't think it's likely is because General Mattis, who now the Secretary of Defense, was the head of the Central Command. I spoke with him. He said he worried about Iran a great deal, but one of his worries was how not to have a war with Iran. With him in place, I feel a little more confident, but it's going to be a struggle. It's going to be a fight within this administration. And in a chaotic, unpredictable administration, anything can happen.
Joe Cerincione, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. I always learn something. Thanks for changing your schedule around so you could be on the show.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times and the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us.